Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
So I have a very interesting episode lined up today featuring Professor Robert H. Frank of Cornell University. We go through his contributions to the field of behavioral economics. We delve into the economic consequences of keeping up with the Joneses, how peer pressure can help us solve climate change and help the fight against COVID, and the strategic role of emotions. Professor Frank is not just a practitioner of the science, he has helped develop this field. So it really was a pleasure to talk to someone at the cutting edge of behavioral economics. I would recommend Professor Frank's book, Under the Influence, which covers a lot of his work on putting peer pressure to work. And there is a link in the podcast description for those who are interested. If you enjoy the podcast to the value of a price of coffee a month, Patreon is a way to contribute to keep the show on the road. I'm putting up bonus material from time to time, and there are opportunities to contribute questions to future guests, discuss what we should get on next, all that sort of stuff. So if you're interested, go to patreon.com/IrishEconPod, patreon.com/IrishEconPod. Now, I didn't set this up, but we touch on weddings in today's episode, and we have a special weddings episode on the Patreon site for those who are interested. So if this whets your appetite for more wedding discussion, head on over to Patreon to check that out. So we begin our chat where I ask Professor Frank about his contributions to the field. He tells us some very interesting stories about how he set up one of the first behavioral economics courses, which came to be after some discussions with the recent Nobel laureate, Richard Taylor.
Okay, I started thinking about economics and behavioral terms in the late 1970s or early 1980s.
Okay.
I had been on leave in Washington, D.C., my first sabbatical leave. I came back to Cornell in 1980. While I'd been away, Richard Thaler arrived at Cornell. I met him shortly after I got back. We spent long hours talking about all the ways in which the economic models that people taught in the classroom didn't seem to fit the world that we saw out there. And it was probably a year or two later that I taught what I think was the first undergraduate course in behavioral economics. Richard Thaler had been teaching the MBA students a course that I think really was a behavioral economics course too. But the undergraduate course, I think, was the first one ever to really think of itself as a behavioral economics course. And I didn't have a ready syllabus, obviously. There wasn't any prescribed body of material to teach students under that heading then. So after some deliberation, I decided to call the course Departures from Rational Choice.
Right.
I don't like that title at all now. I wouldn't call it that if I were doing this for the first time again. I think that just invites a lot of fruitless discussion about what it means to be rational. But that's what I called it. And I had two main headings. One was Departures from Rational Choice with Regret. And that was really the body of material that Richard Thaler was focused on. He had been in the Northwest on a sabbatical of his own with Danny Kahneman and Amos Tversky, and their entire body of work was essentially devoted to the fact that people make mistakes. Those are the kinds of departures from rational choice that I call with regret, because when you explain to people that they've made a mistake, they most of the time feel motivated to change their behavior. Oh, they're taking sunk costs into account. A rational person shouldn't do that. And you know, it takes a while for that idea to seem correct to some people. But once they get it, they want to stop paying attention to sunk costs in the future. The other part of the course that I offered, I entitled Departures from Rational Choice Without Regret. And those are the things that don't fit what the predictions of the standard rational choice model serve up. And yet when you tell people that they're not doing what the model predicts they'll do, they don't seem to have any regret about that at all. So self-interested people, when they're dining at a restaurant far from home by themselves, they won't leave a tip because they're never coming back again. And by the time they've gotten whatever level of service they're going to get from the server, it's too late for her to change the level of service. So why leave a tip? You explain that to people, and almost nobody says, "Oh, thanks for pointing that out. From now on, I won't leave a tip." They think people who would think in those terms are kind of creepy.
Yeah, yeah.
So my own work has really focused much more on goals that people pursue that aren't quite captured in the standard economic model. And I think the main focus has been on what I consider Charles Darwin's central insight, which is that life is graded on the curve. It's not how strong you are. It's not how smart you are in absolute terms that matters for your situation in life. It's how those qualities compare to the corresponding ones that the people competing most directly against have. So it turns out that your ability to achieve many of the most basic goals in life depends not on how much you spend or what qualities you have, but on how much you spend relative to what rivals spend or what qualities you have. That was what I thought would be the second main branch of behavioral economics. But as things turned out, the field developed very rapidly, and it focused almost entirely on what I called departures from rational choice with regret, cognitive errors. And so then at some point I started to wonder, well, maybe I'm not really a behavioral economist after all. Maybe that's not part of this movement. But lately I've come to see that the reason we don't take into account the policy implications of the models that introduce concerns about relative position is that we suffer from a fairly important cognitive illusion that prevents us from seeing why the implications of that model would be in our interest to embrace.
The relative ranking is very interesting because I suppose in a more traditional sense, economists would think, well, we get our utility from what we have in more absolute terms. But your theory would come into play. It's something that resonates intuitively, that we get utility from how we compare to our peers or those around us. And this, it's more of a relative rank as opposed to an absolute rank.
Yeah, I think it's framed in a way that makes people want to keep distance from that way of thinking about things, when in fact it's just a totally natural component of human nature. I think for me, the reason that this seems so important stems ultimately from the fact that I, right out of college, spent 2 years in Nepal. I was a Peace Corps volunteer. I taught math and science in a small village high school. And while I was there, I lived in a two-room house that didn't have any electricity or running water. It was a house that nobody here in Ithaca, New York, would feel okay about living in. If I lived in a house like that here, my kids wouldn't have wanted their friends to know where we live. They would have been ashamed. I would have been ashamed, and that's not because we have any kind of character defect. It's just that living in a house like that here is so woefully jarring in the local context. It's just a like having a big sign around your neck saying, I failed to meet even the minimal expectations of life in this environment. In that environment, it was a totally satisfactory house. I had colleagues and friends over happily. Nobody thought ill of the house. It was, in fact, a fairly nice house. So that's not, if you evaluate things within a frame of reference, that's really the only way we're equipped to make evaluations of that sort. You know, is it cold out? You know, I grew up in Miami, Florida. If it was 60 degrees in the evening in November, we knew the answer. You know, it was freezing. You know, we'd wear every warm garment we had if we went out. If you're in Montreal on a 60 degree afternoon in March, is it cold out? They think you're stupid if you ask the question. No, of course it's not cold out. So context really, really matters.
That resonates with me because I spent a summer in New York, and I remember as an Irish person in New York, there was the one rainy day, or it wasn't rainy, it was actually just cold, and people were complaining, and I had the typical Irish response of, well, at least it's dry, which to me was a good day, but to everybody local was not a good day. But it really does make a lot of sense, I think. In terms of applying that concept, you had a few interesting, I suppose, analogies, and one of them was, I think, was to do with an arms race, and there's other aspects maybe when it comes to issues like wage bargaining and housing markets. Maybe you could tell us a bit about how this sort of perspective can help understand these concepts.
Sure. The arms race narrative is completely uncontroversial. I don't think people divide according to whether they're liberal or conservative or religious or non-religious. It's very simple. It's straightforward. The idea basically is that you have rival nations. They're each worried about being attacked by another country, and so they stockpile armaments to defend themselves. They don't know how much the other side has, so they build a little extra just to be sure, but then the other side builds extra to be sure itself. And to maintain your sense of security, it's rational individually for a country to build more arms. Mm. And yet when each side builds more arms, not only do they not become more secure as a result of doing that, they become less secure.
Yes.
It's exactly analogous to the situation where the person in front of you at a concert stands to see better, and you're forced to see better or else not see at all. You stand. It's not irrational to stand. It's totally rational from your individual point of view to stand. You have no regrets about having stood, and yet you'd all be happier if none of you were standing. Mm. In the case of the military arms race, countries often sign enforceable agreements promising not to stockpile arms beyond a certain limit. And nobody complains in that instance that these agreements violate their rights to build as many arms as they want to build. Mm. That's the whole point of the agreement. They know that if they're free to build as many arms as they want to build, they'll build too many. Mm. So to achieve the outcome both sides want to achieve, they agree not to do that, and they have to have a binding rule that keeps them from doing that.
Yeah, sure.
So whenever you have... So why do you get an arms race? It's because arms matter. The stock of arms you have matters more in relative terms than the stock of other things that you might have besides arms. So if they have better toasters than we have, we don't like that, but we can live with that. If they have more bombs than we have, that's dangerous for our survival. So if relative holdings matter more for one thing than another, you see an escalation of expenditure on the thing where relativity matters more. And the financing for that escalating expenditure in that category comes from taking money away from the other category. So we build fewer roads, fewer hospitals, worse schools, to free up money to build more bombs. Nobody likes the result of that, so they try to make agreements not to do that. It's exactly analogous, the forces that guide spending patterns, both for individuals and from the collective vantage point in ordinary domestic spending. So if I'm a parent, probably my first priority is to get my kids into the best possible school I can. What's true in every country, every state, every city, all around the world is that the better schools are located where the houses are more expensive. That's true even in France, where the budget per pupil is exactly the same. Still, the schools that parents want to see their kids go to are the ones in the more expensive areas. And your imperative then as a parent is to scrape together as much money as you can for a down payment on a house in the best possible school catchment area. To do that, you'll borrow money more than you ought to. You'll reduce your savings imprudently. You'll commute longer distances. You'll work longer hours. You'll work double shifts. You'll work every margin available to you to do that. But the rub, of course, is exactly the same as in a military arms race when everybody bids more intensively for a house in a better school district. They succeed only in bidding up the prices of those houses. Still, half of all the kids end up going to bottom half schools, the same as if nobody had done that.
Hmm.
And the way most governments have tried to push back against that arms race is they tax people while they're working, and then they use the proceeds from those taxes to fund retirement pension payments. Except for the fact that they taxed that money away from you while you were working, you would have spent it on a fruitless bidding war for a house in a better school district. At least this way, you know, everyone goes to the same schools as before, but you get a pension payment, and that's better than we would have had otherwise.
Sure. What really resonates with me is that it reminds me of the first thing, one of the first things you learn in economics was the whole idea of conspicuous consumption. And the example would be something like a fur coat. And most people would think of a fur coat as being something that's very extravagant and a rare expenditure, whereas it actually relates to more common expenditures, and it has a knock-on effect on other expenditures. And because of this constraint that you can only have so much income or whatever, you know, it affects your welfare in other ways, which is very interesting.
I think that's one reason that people have been slow to take this whole problem seriously, because it's been framed by so many people as, oh, they're just trying to show off, they're just trying to posture and look like they have more money than they have. They're insecure, shallow people. No, it's really far more fundamental than that. The things you spend money on are important for your ability to feel like you've achieved the goal you were trying to achieve. In the U.S., think about the amount families are spending on wedding receptions. It's now three times as much in real terms as it was in 1980. Nobody getting married today is any happier because of that. You know, the effect of that threefold increase in real dollar expenditures has been simply to raise the bar that defines the kind of celebration people expect. You know, when I got married, I'd never even heard of a destination wedding. Now my kids are going to destination bachelor parties all in distant locations. You know, it's money spent in those ways. We've got a big literature on the determinants of human flourishing. We know that money spent in those ways doesn't make any difference for anybody. You know, raises the sense of what people feel they need, but it doesn't make them happier or healthier. The mansions all get twice as big. The people living in them aren't any happier. They're probably less happy because it's more trouble to manage the bigger property. And those are all dollars that could be spent on useful things.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. It's interesting you mentioned weddings, because that's something that's been touched on previously, actually, in the podcast. So it's nice to get your perspective. And it's definitely something that's experienced this side of the Atlantic also. So before we move on from this, a lot of your work is perhaps on the concepts. Have you done any empirical analysis to try and see these outcomes in the field, or where does it fit in maybe perhaps on other theories that explain this behavior.
The empirical work that relates most directly to the issues we've just discussed is work I did with a former undergraduate and a colleague to explore what we call the expenditure cascade. That's the fact that since 1970, roughly, there's been a sharp increase in inequality that's occurred in the U.S., also in many other countries. The pattern is one where almost all of the income growth has gone to people at the top of the income ladder. Mm. Most of it to people in the top 20% in that group. It's mostly the top 5%. If you look within that group, it's the top 1% that have gotten the lion's share of the gains. And that's true no matter how high up you go. It's more and more concentrated. And the people at the very top spend more. Why? Because that's what people do at every level. When they have more, they spend more. The people in the middle don't get angry when they see the people at the top spending more. They want to see pictures of the mansions and the yachts and the parties. The people just below the top, though, they travel in the same circles. That shifts their frame of reference, so they build bigger. They spend more on their celebrations. And then there's a group just below them that overlaps. They spend more, too. And it cascades all the way down. And so that expenditure cascade, if you can't invoke a narrative along those lines, very difficult to explain why the median new house in the U.S. is now 50% larger than it was in 1980. It's risen in price by even more than 50%. That's anomalous because the median earner earns essentially the same real hourly wage as in 1980. Why are they spending so much more? The answer is that people like them are spending more, but then why are people like them spending more? You have to go all the way up to the top to see the first move in that cascade. And so that's the narrative. And to test that, what we did was we looked at changes in inequality in different census districts in the U.S. So we looked at the county level. The 100 largest counties, income inequality went up in just about all of them, but it didn't go up at the same rate in all of them. It went up much more sharply in some than in others. And our theory predicts that where inequality rises more sharply, we will see greater symptoms of financial distress among the people living in those areas because they're trying to keep up with a standard that they can't afford to keep up with. And it was a crude assessment, but we found three measures that we thought reliably tracked that were footprints of financial distress. One was the rate at which families filed for bankruptcy in the counties where inequality grew the most. The rate of bankruptcy filings grew most sharply in those counties. The couples counselors will tell you that people come to see them for many reasons, but they almost never see a couple for whom financial distress isn't at least one of the worries that has brought them there. And so we see in the counties where inequality grew the most, the rate of increase of divorce was greatest in those counties, too. And the third measure we tracked was the proportion of commutes to and from work longer than 1 hour each way. There, the idea is that if you're having a hard time making ends meet, one margin you can work is to move farther from the center where land is cheaper, and just endure the punishing commute back and forth to work. And so that's a very common symptom of inequality here in Aspen, Colorado. People commute for 2 hours to the service. The tradespeople who work in the hotels and resorts in Aspen can't afford to live anywhere near Aspen because the prices, they have to commute 2 or 3 hours. So all those measures consistently showed greater increase when inequality grew more.
Interesting. Wow, that's a nice identification strategy to get at that effect. It's really something that the economists among us can take from that. I suppose that brings us on then to your more recent work on more sort of peer effects in your book Under the Influence. And I'll I'll put a link to that in the description for the podcast if anybody's interested. Perhaps you can tell us a bit about the general idea. I suppose it's more formal concept of peer pressure. Would that be correct?
Yeah, I didn't want to have the term peer pressure appear anywhere in the title or subtitle. My editor finally persuaded me to think about putting peer pressure to work as the subtitle, and that had enough of a man bites dog aspect to it that I thought, yeah, let's go with that. It has a very negative valence in this culture. I'm sure that's common in many other cultures too. Parents always are at great pains to teach their kids not to follow the dumb examples of their friends. And so peer pressure has a very negative connotation, but the psychologists have long stressed that it's a hugely important influence on what people do. They have a saying, they say, it's the situation, not the person. And by that, what they mean is that if you see somebody behave in a certain way, our natural impulse is to ask, well, what kind of a person would do such a thing? And so we think about traits of character or personality. No, that's the wrong way to think about it, say the psychologists. You really want to look at the social circumstances surrounding the decision. That's really where all the action is going to lie in most cases. And so if you're worried, for example, that your daughter will become a smoker, it doesn't help to know that she likes science fiction novels. It doesn't help to know that she's a football fan or is good in math. None of that tells you anything useful. What you want to know is what's the proportion of her friends who smoke. If that number rises, she is much more likely to become a smoker. It's a big effect. There's no other effect that compares with it. So if the percentage of her friends who smoke goes from 20 to 30%, for example, she becomes 25% more likely to become a smoker. It's huge. That's long been known. I think most people intuitively don't realize how strong the effect is. But if you read the evidence on it, it's incontrovertibly a strong effect. What's true too, and I think we hear much less about this, is that the causal arrows also run in the opposite direction. So the social environment affects us for good and ill, for ill in the case of smoking, but often for good. What's the social environment? That's a consequence of the decisions we take. So the smoking rate is just the number of us who smoke over the total number of us. So when we decide to smoke, we affect the smoking rate, which in turn affects whether people like us will smoke. But since our own individual effect on the social environment is so small, we typically neglect it. It's not worth worrying about. So very few people would say, oh, I better not smoke. I might make others more likely to smoke. That's a very uncommon kind of thought pattern. But if there were some way, I mean, clearly the social environment matters for us. If people do good things around, if they diet prudently and exercise regularly, we're more likely to do that too. If the social environment around us encouraged benign behaviors we want to see become more frequent in ourselves and our children, that would be a good thing. If the social environment encourages harmful behaviors, we'd want to see less of that. And so nobody, as far as I can tell, has really thought systematically about whether there's any way to act on the insight that if we could encourage people to behave as if they cared about their effect on the social environment, should we do that? And when you start thinking about that, then there's just an avalanche of simple, useful steps that we can take that would encourage people to make choices that would have beneficial effects on the social environment, which in turn would ramify back in the other direction. Taxing cigarettes is the simplest example, but there's just a whole host of simple steps we could take that would produce huge gains without requiring painful sacrifices really from anyone.
So perhaps do you have any examples? I think two things that come to mind, of course, is climate change, and that's definitely something that we can influence those around us. But one that comes to mind, I don't know if you have any insights, is some of the social distancing measures that we need to take, and wearing a mask, for example. I see that as being one that perhaps we could learn from your theories. There's a collective benefit for everybody to wear a face mask. And one way that you could perhaps establish that routine is if there was some sort of social norm in place.
Yes, it's by far the easiest, most direct pathway to getting everyone to wear a mask. What can you do about that? You can wear a mask. When people see you wearing a mask, they're much more likely to wear one. If you're out for a walk and you pass somebody, you're wearing a mask and he isn't, he's a little embarrassed in most cases to see you've gone to the trouble of doing it and he hasn't. So, yeah, I think that's and the more prominent you are in the hierarchy, the more important your example is. And so that's been our curse here, is that the very people at the top of the hierarchy, at least in nominal terms, have been disdainful of wearing masks. And so we've got in many parts of the country very, very low compliance with that norm.
And when it comes to the climate change, then, have you covered any examples in terms of how under the influence and how this sort of social pressure can affect climate change?
Probably the most vivid example where we have hard data concerns solar panel adoption. So there was a seminal study early in the adoption cycle in California. If there was one new adoption in a neighborhood, the effect of that was within 4 months' time to stimulate a second new adoption, one that wouldn't have occurred but for the fact that people saw the first one. It's actually statistically quite a complex set of hoops you've got to jump through to establish that it was caused by the first adoption and not by other factors that would have led to an adoption. But they can sort that out with large samples. And so in 4 months' time, you started with one, then you've got two. In eight months' time, each of those spawns in the next 4 months a new adoption. So you've got one, two, then four of them after 8 months. After 2 years, you've got a stock of 32 solar panel adoptions in that one neighborhood alone that wouldn't have occurred except for that first one having occurred at time zero. It's a huge effect, but it doesn't stop there, because each of those people has family members scattered about the country, or friends in other places. They talk to, oh, we put solar panels up, you should see the effect it's had on our electric bill. People are going to be adopting them in other places too as a result of that one new adoption. So I think there's been a long argument in the climate debate: does individual action matter? I long held the traditional economist view that no, it doesn't. What we really need to do is adopt robust changes in public policies, a stiff carbon tax, massive investment in green energy infrastructure and the like. If we don't do that, we're never going to solve the problem. I still think we need those things, but I have completely backed away from my sense that individual action doesn't matter, just because it's so much more impactful because of the indirect effects of it. But in addition to that, taking the steps like that, eating less meat, walking when you could have driven, those steps by themselves don't matter. They have indirect effects that matter quite a lot in some cases. But more important than all of that is that taking those steps changes who you are. I think the standard move by economists is to say, well, you come into the world with fixed identities and preferences. No, said Aristotle, we construct who we are over time gradually by what we do. Habits and daily actions shape us.
It feels like, so these sort of effects amplify maybe the benefit of a carbon tax, and that you have these sort of knock-on network type effects.
Yes. Yeah, a carbon tax has probably a small effect on each individual person, but the ultimate effect is massive. You know, so if if we had a little tax on meat, we could make it revenue neutral. That is to say, we'll collect all the revenue from the tax on meat and then give it back to the people who paid it in a check each month. Since rich people eat much more expensive meat and more meat than poor people, the low and middle income families would get more back in a rebate check each month than they'd paid. But still, the effect of that would be to make meat more expensive than non-meat things in your diet. So people would have an incentive to shift gradually toward more plant-based sources of food in their diet. And as people did that, it would just become the custom to eat in a different way because others like you would be doing.
I'm not a vegetarian, but I have been around a lot of vegetarians where I feel the pressure not to eat meat.
Yeah.
So it works, definitely.
Yeah. And, you know, you don't have to become a vegetarian. You know, we can all, you know, most of us eat way more meat than is good for us. And why do we do that? Because other people eat it. It's the custom to eat in that way. And if the custom changed, we wouldn't feel any sense of deprivation at all about eating less of it.
So the power of a lot of these effects seems to be that when you go back to your solar panel example, that I get the recommendation from somebody I trust, and therefore I'm perhaps more likely to act on that than if I heard it from, you know, an official source or just
yes.
in a pamphlet. How do we harness that effect then if we want to, you know, make a policy based on this sort of theory?
Well, if we had a stiff, and I'll say revenue neutral because I think that's the way to get it adopted, carbon tax, call it a carbon fee dividend program, if you don't like the word tax, which is probably smart marketing to call it that instead of a tax, you would make power from solar much cheaper for all families, low income, middle income, high income alike. More people would adopt solar panels, and you wouldn't need to take any other step. We know that when there's a solar panel on the street side of the house and people can see it, it has much more impact on surrounding family adoptions than if it's in the back of the house where you can't see it. So just getting a few people to shift launches that process, and it just takes off on its own after that. Companies always try to use peer testimonials to get you to try their product. Of course, you can have public service messages that exploit that strategy too.
Okay, interesting. That is, very interesting. And we can all think of examples where we can see that has been used in advertisement, but now it makes more sense as to why it was there.
And the utility companies, they report that the very most effective conservation message they've ever tried has been to tell you how much power you use compared to your neighbors.
Yeah.
So if you use more power than your neighbors and they report that to you, that's the biggest effect of any message they've tried in getting people to reduce their consumption.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
Yes. Okay, right. Well, maybe you can move on to some of your other work then. And one thing that I found very interesting was when you talked about the strategic use of emotions and how that comes into play. And when we talk about Econ 101, we think about Adam Smith and the Invisible Hand. Our own self-interest guides us towards the social optimal. But perhaps you would say that sort of self-interested behavior can lead us away from a socially optimal outcome.
Yeah, I think it's true that there are many people who are ruthless. If there's any chance to exploit consumers, cheat them out of what they rightfully expect from a transaction and get away with it, then we know there are people out there who will do that. There was a good book published a couple of years ago by Bob Shiller and George Akerlof, where they sort of describe the various scams that the commercial sector carries out routinely across a whole variety of sectors. And so we know that the same self-interest motive that drives producers to do what Adam Smith described in The Wealth of Nations, which is to introduce quality improvements and cost-saving innovations to expand their market share, you know, that's been a benevolent force in general. That's the invisible hand. That same energy also guarantees that they're going to cheat whenever they can get away with it. And so the issue is always how do we ever see honesty and fair dealing emerge in a world where there are still opportunities to cheat without probability of getting punished for it. And so that was an early strand in my own work. I've always been interested in evolution, and the challenge is to explain why people would refrain from cheating if they knew they wouldn't be punished for doing it in a competitive arena where what matters for your ability to succeed is how much material resources you get. So if you cheat and nobody knows you cheated and you get more stuff, then it seems like there's not only have an incentive to cheat, you must cheat, because if you don't cheat, others will cheat and they'll get more payoff than you and they'll drive you to extinction. And it turns out that if there are individuals who don't cheat under those circumstances, and this is the big if they're in some observable way different from the ones who do cheat, and they can spot that element that makes them different in one another, then they can interact selectively with one another and reap the gains from successful cooperation in situations that require trust. So here's a thought experiment. You've gotten home from a crowded concert. You had an envelope with a 10,000 pounds in it. You were going to buy a car the next day. The owner wanted cash. You get home. The envelope is that had the cash in it is not in your coat pocket anymore. You remember the sound of it falling out. Oh, that must have been the envelope fell out as I was leaving the event. Can you think of anybody not related to you by blood or marriage who you feel sure would return your money if she found it? Well, most people will say yes. They can. They could name many such people. They usually will name somebody they know well. Mm-hmm. How do they know that she'd return the money? It can't be that she found 10,000 pounds before and returned at that time. They seem to believe that they know this person well enough to say, well, if she found my money, she wouldn't even think about keeping it. She'd feel so bad about the idea. So we feel it's possible to know people well enough to predict that they wouldn't do that in some situations where they could do it and get away with it. So if we have that capacity to make statistically reliable judgments of trustworthiness, then that's all it takes for spontaneous trust to emerge.
Right, okay.
Now, it takes more than that, you don't get a uniformly honest population on the strength of that alone. I mean, there's still going to be cheaters out there. You have to be vigilant, but you can get honest behavior even without rules under those circumstances. And we've done experiments to show that when you have people play games with strangers where it's possible to cheat your partner with no chance of detection, people predict much better than chance accuracy who'll cheat and who won't. The Theory of Moral Sentiment, Smith's book from 1859, said you couldn't have markets without the moral values that enable people to trust one another. People have lost sight of that book for the most part in the years since, but it's still a very important book.
It seems to tie in with, similar to what we said before, maybe, that if you're going to interact with somebody, it's almost like a repeated game, that if you're going to be repeated interactions with somebody, well, then it's in your own interest to have to be trustworthy.
But then is that really trustworthiness if your material incentives favor being honest when you know you're going to keep interacting with a person, then maybe you're just being prudent rather than trustworthy.
Yeah, true. Yeah. Okay.
But to even there, it's hard to be prudent in those situations because you have to refrain from cheating now on the first move. So you pay a cost now by doing that in the hope of getting a larger payoff in the future. But people aren't very good at that. You know, they have a hard time passing up immediate gains in order to reap larger future gains. Self-control is a ubiquitous human shortcoming. And so if you care about treating your partner fairly, it's easier to pass up the current gain and initiate a string of successful ongoing trusting interactions. So it helps. It helps there too if you care about doing the right thing.
Right. So there's a value in actually caring and being a good person, essentially.
Yeah, that brings the payoff from doing the right thing up front. You know.
Yeah, sure.
In the other way of thinking about it, you have to wait till the future interaction to get paid, but you avoid the sting of guilt and shame by doing the right thing now.
So, okay. So the other work that you're quite well known for is this, the economic naturalist type work, and really interesting insights into maybe everyday phenomena. And just before we go into it, maybe you could tell us where this idea came from.
The origin of it came in the 1980s. I was teaching an upper level undergraduate course, and Cornell has something called the Knight Writing Program, K-N-I-G-H-T. It's financed by the Knight Foundation. Their aim was to get professors to assign more papers in their courses. There's a very persuasive body of research showing that writing about a subject is a really good way to learn about it. You can read about it, you can talk to other people about it, but if you actually write something about an idea, that gets it into your head in a way that some of the other approaches don't. So the problem they knew was that professors are reluctant to assign papers because that means they'll have to grade them. And so what the program did was they trained teaching assistants, graduate teaching assistants, to give feedback to students on their papers. And so we could assign papers. The TAs would grade them and give detailed feedback on them. And so I had a TA provided to me for free for a couple of years, and I got to doing that. The support for the program went away, but I could see how effective it was. And so I felt like I was under some obligation to keep doing it. But where I used to have 20-page papers, I wasn't willing to do that if I had to read them. So it went down to 10 pages and then 5 pages. Finally, 500 words is where I settled, because that's all it took to respond adequately to the ultimate form of the assignment that I gave, which was to pose an interesting question based on something that you've either witnessed yourself or experienced personally, and then use basic economic principles to craft a plausible answer to your question. It's not so easy to pose an interesting question, so the students have to do that twice in the term. The first effort is often unsuccessful. It's they'll say, how come we order out for pizza the night after we've been up all night studying for an exam? Oh, it's because we're dead tired the next day and it's too hard to cook when you're tired. If that's the paper, I tell them, well, yes, that's a correct application of the cost-benefit principle. Yes, it's correct, but it's not interesting. It's so obvious, I don't want to go knock on a colleague's door and say, listen to this question. So how do you know if your question is interesting? Ask your friends the question. If their eyes light up, yeah, why is that? Then it's interesting. If they just blink dully, then no, probably it's not very interesting. But
okay.
But they, on the second round, almost always come up with a question that's more interesting than the first round, and the best ones are really interesting.
So Professor Frank's connection dropped out briefly there as he was explaining the setup to his favorite economic naturalist question. Why do brides spend a lot of money on a wedding dress that can only be worn once, whereas grooms often rent a suit or tuxedo, even though that can be used many times afterwards?
It seems exactly backwards. The brides ought to rent a dress and the grooms ought to buy a tuxedo that they can wear over and over again.
Sure.
Her answer, this was Jennifer Dulski, who was the author of this paper. She started with a strong assumption, but it's not one that I've ever heard anybody question. She said on important social occasions, it's more important for women to make a fashion statement than for men. Most people seem to say, yeah, that's the way it is here too.
Yeah,
if you
absolutely
accept that assumption, she said it immediately follows that if you tried to make a fashion statement with a rental gown, they would have to stock scores of gowns in each size, or else you'd end up at your wedding wearing a gown that somebody had worn to a wedding that your friends had gone to last month. If they did that, then the gowns would rent out every 7 or 8 months or once a year. They would have to, the carrying costs of having such a large idle inventory would be so great, they would have to rent the gowns out for more even than the purchase price of the gowns. And so why would anybody rent one when you could buy it for less? And with the tuxedo, guys just don't seem to care that they're wearing a suit like the other guys wore at the last wedding people went to. So what?
And
if you don't care, then you can serve the market with two or three suits in each size. They're going to rent out 12 or 14 times a year. You can rent them out for $100 a suit. And if you're trying to save some money when cash is tight, that's a step you can take that's very attractive to lots of people.
That's really interesting. And you can probably apply some of your other theories there in terms of peer pressure and the relative value. Because
there's a whole host of interesting questions people can ask and answer. And the real value of the exercise is that, you know, I circulate the best papers, and then students just talk about them with one another. They go home for holidays. That's the topic of conversation around the dinner. Each time you describe one of these examples to people, you get a little bit better at your grasp of whatever principle it is that's driving the example. And in economics, at least, there's really only a handful of basic principles that do most of the heavy lifting. And if you really use them repeatedly in contexts that you're familiar with, you'll know them at a deep level after just a single semester.
Yeah, I always think that one thing you know when you've got to the end of your economics training is that your mind works like a supply and demand diagram. If you had like a cartoon and one of these cartoon bubbles, it would be a supply and demand diagram, and that would be one way of developing that skill, I think. Okay, well, maybe just before we wrap up, one thing that might be really interesting is that you have done work on asking the question whether studying economics inhibits cooperation. Maybe you could tell us a bit about where that idea came from and what your findings were.
The economic model that's most often taught is the self-interest standard of rational choice that presumes that people are narrowly self-interested. It's not that economists insist that there are no other motives, but they think that's by far the most important one. And if you use what some economists think of as the alternative to the self-interest standard of rational choice, which I call the warm glow model. So why do you give money to the charities that solicit you? It's because you get a warm glow from doing that. That seems to be descriptive. If you give money to the public radio station that asks for a contribution, you get a warm glow from doing that. So maybe that's, so we set out to test, Tom Gilovich and Dennis Regan and I set out to test whether studying economics and teaching students that model over and over again affected the frequency with which you behaved in a narrowly self-interested way. And to do that, we had people play prisoner's dilemma games in the lab with one another in groups of three. They would talk for 30 minutes with two strangers and then pair off and fill out forms, each person separately, and play prisoner's dilemma games with each of the other two. You could cooperate or defect. As in all prisoner's dilemmas, if you defect, you get a higher payoff no matter what the other person does. But if both of you defect, you both do worse than if each of you cooperates. And what we were interested in was not just what people would do, that had been well studied. And in fact, most people didn't defect, which is contrary to the prediction of the standard model. But we were interested in whether people could predict who would defect and who would cooperate. And the cooperation rate was about 25%. Excuse me, the defection rate was about 25%, which is already a strong refutation of the self-interest model. But when people predicted their partner would defect, if those predictions weren't informative, they'd be right by chance 25% of the time, since that was the base rate of defection. In fact, when you predicted your partner would defect, you were right 60% of the time, way more than chance. So even in very brief interactions, people were able to predict who would cheat, even though there was no way anybody would know after the fact who had cheated and who hadn't, since your payoff that you got at the end of the experiment was the sum of the two game payoffs plus a random term that just sort of jumbled the picture enough so you couldn't tell who had done what. And what we found was that if you were an economics major, you were twice as likely to defect in those games as if you were a non-major. And that raises the question of whether that's just a selection effect. Is it the people who are more selfish to begin with are more drawn to study economics? Or is it a training effect? And we found some evidence of a training effect because the difference between economics majors and non-majors in terms of their cooperation rates was larger the longer they had studied economics. And we looked at the cooperation rate at the beginning of the semester and then again at the end of the semester in an introductory economics course, and found that the cooperation rate was much lower at the end of the semester in the economics course. It was higher at the end of the semester in an introductory astronomy course, which was our control group in that experiment.
I was just going to say, is this a training? Is it a being in university effect, or is it a being in economics effect? But you've controlled for that, definitely.
Students who were not majors in economics got more cooperative as they moved through their experience.
Okay,
at
well,
the
then,
university.
That removes all doubt. Okay, well, that is a very interesting note to end on. Well, thank you very much, Professor Frank. These are topics that I can talk forever, but I really enjoyed it and it was very interesting.
Yeah, it was a pleasure to chat with you, and I look forward to hearing the result of whatever you do to it when you post it.
Absolutely. Okay, so thanks everybody for listening. If you like the podcast, perhaps think about giving us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts. If you really like the episode and want to hear more about weddings, football, and just want to help keep the show on the road, check out the Patreon at patreon.com/IrishEconPod.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.